Marge Potasek was searching for the purpose of her life and the truth that would tie everything together to make sense of what was taught and what was happening on our planet. The fire that was creating all the smoke. Through many experiences, she was finally led to the knowledge book that provided all the answers. She is now talking about this gift to humanity on Knowledge Book Radio, so all can be united in peace, love, and harmony. Please call 1-973-787-7035 or email mmjp99@gmail.com with questions. If you send your postal address to mmjp99@gmail.com, you will receive 3 chapters of the Knowledge Book as a gift. Now, here is your host, Marge Potasek.
You're listening to the Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek on Transformation Talk Radio. For the next allocated time that we have, we will continue our series of Omega Talks. Now, these talks are given once a month on the fourth Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. East Coast Time. The Omega Talks are part of the unification program of the Call to Friendship Association that's talked about in the Knowledge Book. Now, in these talks, we connect the world knowledge to the Omega Dimension, which is a union of central suns, or the 19th dimension. And the 19th dimension has been closed up until this time, has been inaccessible to the world human until now. And for the first time, this dimension, the Omega dimension, the 19th dimension, is now open to humanity through the Knowledge Book. So the topic for this month as part of the World Unification Program for March 2023 is the Monarch Butterfly. Now, legend holds that Prince William of Orange, who later became King William III, was so adored by some early European settlers in North America that they bequeathed the name Monarch to the very orange and regal butterfly in his honor. Whether this is true or not true, we don't know, but the monarch is a majestic insect worthy of the title. Metamorphosis, mimicry, and a mind-blowing migration may indeed make it the king of all the butterflies. So to say a Chinese proverb in a different way, to paraphrase it as follows, a journey of 3,000 miles begins with a single step. Now, in the case of monarchs, the first step is its being laid as a single cream-colored egg attached to the underside of a milkweed leaf. Female monarchs lay 1 to 3 eggs on the underside of milkweed leaves, and this process is repeated until the female has laid hundreds of eggs. So 1 to 3 eggs per leaf basically allows each of those eggs that become caterpillars to have enough food, and so they have enough food and there's less competition for food. And by spreading the eggs from milkweed to milkweed, then there's a much better chance of all the caterpillars to succeed in getting food. And the female can lay up to 500 eggs. Now, after 4 days, it hatches as a single, hungry, 2-millimeter-long caterpillar. Now, if anyone is familiar with The Hungry Little Caterpillar, that is a children's book, I believe that this caterpillar, the monarch butterfly caterpillar, is the inspiration for that book. So after a few minutes, this newly hatched caterpillar has its first meal, and he eats the egg cover first. And from then on, it seldom stops eating for the next 2 weeks. Now, his diet, or the caterpillar's diet, is very limited. They could only eat milkweed. And the caterpillar eats and grows, grows and eats, and they grow so much that the skin becomes too tight and it has to get out of the skin, much like outgrowing old clothes. for the caterpillar to keep growing, molting must occur, which means the outside part, the skin part of the caterpillar needs to be shed, so the old skin splits and it reveals the new skin underneath. The caterpillar wriggles free of the too tight skin, and after freeing itself, the molted caterpillar often eats its old skin before moving on to other more milkweed leaves. Now, the monarch larvae go through a total of 5 instar stages. Now, an instar is a phase between 2 periods of molting. And this is done in every insect that develops as a larva. So the caterpillar grows to over 20 times or up to 45 millimeters. This is about 1.5 inches to 2 inches in length. And it grows to 2,700 times in weight. So that's a lot of eating for this hungry little caterpillar. And each instar stage transformation is marked by the shedding of its exoskeleton. So as you can see here, you have the initial, where's my pointer? Okay, you see the initial little caterpillar, then it gets bigger, then it gets bigger, then it gets bigger, and that gets even bigger. It's amazing, the growth. Now at the final molt, the caterpillar crawls away from the milkweed plant in search of a safe spot to begin the pupa stage of the monarch butterfly life cycle. So it has spinnerets near its mouth, and with those spinnerets, it creates a tiny silken pad with a button at the center. This is done on whatever place that it decided to rest on, that it considers safe. Then it carefully hooks the tail end of its body into the pad and drops head first to hang in the shape of a J. And there he is, hanging in the shape of a J, waiting for the next stage. So in a few hours, the skin splits at the head one last time and falls away to reveal a green structure that hardens into a smooth, waxy shell flecked with gold. The making of the chrysalis is complete. So it's amazing how out of the caterpillar comes this yellow-green shape, and then eventually winds up being a chrysalis that gets hard. It becomes this beautiful jade-colored chrysalis that hangs off whatever location the caterpillar chose. So the chrysalis hardens, and for the next week or two, the butterfly develops within this protective case. To maximize camouflage, the black and orange colors don't develop until just before emergence. So to make sure that it is safe and that it is not attacked by predators. Because eventually the skin of the chrysalis turns transparent, you can see what's inside. So once the skin turns transparent and the orange color comes in, orange and black, the adult butterfly is now ready to emerge from the chrysalis. And when the chrysalis opens, the butterfly crawls out head first. And as you can see, the wings are small and the body is big and plump. So these are empty wings, basically a shell for the wings, and it has full color and it's ready. So the wings hang limp. The butterfly hangs upside down from its support. So what the butterfly does is it pumps its body fluid through its wing veins in order to make them get bigger and get turgid. Then the butterfly cannot fly in this state because the wings are too heavy if they're filled with fluid. Then the monarch needs to wait for air to replace some of the fluid in the wings. And when this happens, the monarch will be able to fly, but until that point, the monarch is very vulnerable, and at this point, the wings can be easily damaged. So if you see a monarch butterfly hanging off some kind of a support, In this stage, it is best not to touch it, let it go on its merry way and become a truly beautiful butterfly that is then able to fly. So once the wings have hardened, the butterfly flies away to find its first meal. And from this point on, the monarch drinks all of its food. And the butterfly will visit several different kinds of flowers to get its nectar for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So it no longer feeds on, it no longer feeds on milkweed, no longer chews its food, it drinks its food, and goes from flower to flower collecting nectar. Now, once the monarch butterfly has attained the ability to fly, it is now faced with the task of traveling to its wintering location, maybe 3,000 miles away. Now, we've all heard of the salmon going upstream. The butterflies are not like the salmon, because the salmon knows exactly where it is going when it swims upstream, because it is literally returning back to its birthplace. It's going back to the chemical composition of the water where it was first hatched. However, the monarch has never been to its target location. It has not been taught by any previous generations of butterflies, because the previous four generations, the previous four instars, have never been to this location either. So how do they know where they are going, and how are they able to navigate, and how do they know this is where they need to go in order to stay safe over the winter? So each fall, North American monarchs travel from their summer breeding grounds to overwintering locations. East of the Rocky Mountains, monarchs travel up to an astonishing 3,000 miles to central Mexico, where the shorter migration west of the Rockies is to the California coast. So east of the Rockies, all the monarchs wind up going to central Mexico, while west of the Rockies, they overwinter along the California coast. So you've got two kinds of butterflies here. Same butterfly, but different migration path and different migration location. There is evidence of some interchange between the eastern and the western populations. So how does that happen? Well, maybe when individuals cross the Rocky Mountains, when butterflies fly from western U.S. to the Mexico wintering sites, or butterflies from the Mexican sites fly into the western U.S. So there seems to be an interchange between the two types of butterflies when they somehow maybe get blown off course, or they make a mistake, or they get mixed up. So what triggers this? Decreasing day length and temperatures, along with aging milkweed and fewer nectar sources, trigger a change in the monarchs. This change signifies the beginning of the migratory generation. And unlike summer generations that live for 2 to 6 weeks as adults, adults of the migratory generation can live up to 9 months. Most monarch butterflies start to change after about mid-August in the eastern U.S., and they stop reproduction and begin to migrate south in search of the overwintering grounds where they have never been before. From across the eastern U.S. and southern Canada, monarchs funnel towards Mexico, and along the way they find refuge in stopover sites with abundant nectar sources and shelter from harsh weather. So if anyone has gardens or anyone has the ability to plant flowers, it would be good to plant nectar-rich plants and flowers so that the monarchs could have fuel for their journey from the northeast to the southwest. And of course, if you have the ability again to have access to garden or some kind of a plant, then maybe it's also a good idea to plant milkweed so that the monarch has the chance to, number one, lay its eggs, and then for the eggs to develop into caterpillars and then go on growing and becoming monarchs. Now, when they reached their destination in central Mexico in early November, monarchs aggregate in Oyamel fir trees in south-southwest facing mountain slopes. Now, these locations provide cool temperatures, water, and adequate shelter to protect them from predators and allow them to conserve enough energy to survive the winter. In March, this generation begins the journey north into Texas and southern states, laying eggs and sipping nectar as they migrate and breed. So each generation goes further northeast. Each generation goes further northeast. So they start out from central Mexico. Then they wind up in Texas. They have its first instar in Texas. Then that generation goes further north, flies further north, creates another instar. And by the time it gets to the fourth instar, they are now in Canada and in the far northeast of the United States. So the first generation offspring from the overwintering population continue the journey from the southern U.S. to recolonize the eastern breeding grounds, migrating north to the central latitudes in approximately late April through May. Second and third generations populate the breeding grounds throughout the summer. It is generally the fourth generation that begins where we started this topic, migrating through the central and southern U.S. and northern Mexico to the wintering sites in central Mexico. In any given year, adult monarchs west of the Rocky Mountains leave overwintering sites along the California coast, with a small number of sites in Baja California and Arizona. In February and March, they head inland in search of milkweed on which to deposit their eggs. Once first-generation monarch eggs reach adulthood, they disperse east across the Central Valley and north across most of the western states. Second and third-generation monarchs live and die throughout spring and summer, generally staying in the same areas where they hatched. The fourth generation, along with late bloomers from the third generation, emerge in late summer to fall. This migratory generation lives 6 to 9 months compared to the 2 to 5 weeks of earlier generations. And here we have, here we have the stages, caterpillar to the J shape, to the chrysalis, to the hardened chrysalis in which the monarch butterfly is developing. The later stages of development where the skin becomes transparent and the wings are actually seen, the colors are seen. The butterfly emerging from now the transparent casing. And of course, they're pumping their wings with water, with fluid from their bodies, and then waiting for air to replace the water, and then they're able to actually fly. Now, Western migratory monarchs also differ biologically from the non-migratory generations. They are in a state of reproductive diapause, meaning their reproductive organs do not mature until later in the adult stage after winter. So there is a biological difference between the Western and the Eastern monarchs. And the dividing line, of course, is the Rocky Mountains. Instead of looking for milkweed, fourth generation Western monarchs require nectar to build lipid reserves as they migrate south and west to the overwintering sites along the California coast and also in Baja California and Arizona. And they arrive at their overwintering site around late October. And once they arrive, they roost for the winter in eucalyptus, Monterey cypress, Monterey pine, and other trees, sometimes in aggregations of thousands of individuals. I remember seeing a program about the monarch butterflies, and when they showed the overwintering location, you couldn't tell one butterfly from the next butterfly because they were on top of each other, taking up all the space on the tree. In February and March, reproductive diapause ends and the annual cycle starts anew. Milkweed and nectar plant availability throughout the spring, summer, and fall benefits Western monarchs. In areas of the desert southwest, monarchs use nectar and milkweed plants throughout much of the year. So it is important to preserve these beauties and to be able to have them to still be around, to plant milkweed and to plant flowers with large nectar sources. Now, monarchs are not only found in the United States and in North America. Monarchs are found in many places throughout the world, but they probably originated in the Americas, and they spread either with the help of humans or on their own to other places. So they are found in Australia and New Zealand and many islands east of these countries. Most islands between Australia and Tahiti have monarchs. They are also found in Hawaii, most islands in the Caribbean, and even sometimes in Western Europe. And although they are found in many places around the world, the monarch is considered a New Zealand native because it became established here on its own. Scientists believe that monarchs were blown from New Caledonia and or Vanuatu to Australia via cyclones and then blown over to New Zealand a few years later. And unlike their northern relatives, monarchs in New Zealand do not appear to migrate. They have adopted their behavior to suit local conditions. Now, when the air temperature drops to about 12.8 degrees Celsius or 55 Fahrenheit, monarchs look for overwintering sites. So they do rest even in the location where they stay and don't migrate. Tagging data shows that most butterflies stay within the area where they became adults. So if you see this picture, this little patch, that's the tag on the butterfly. So those people who are taking care and trying to figure out where they go and how they go and what they're doing and what they're eating, they capture the butterflies, place this very, very light patch on them, and that patch contains information as to where that butterfly was found. And then eventually they'll be found where the destination to which they went. Now, overwintering monarchs prefer sites that are sheltered from the wind, have trees with a rough bark surface on which to cling, and have nearly nearby source of nectar. The butterflies are mostly inactive, but on warm days they do fly, bask in the sunlight, and feed. When the temperatures warm up, butterflies become active again. So I guess they become kind of like a somewhat a hibernation state where they don't eat and they don't move until it gets warmer, in which case they wake up and are able to eat some more and then go back to somewhat kind of asleep. Now, there are many creatures that travel, that migrate. And science has been trying to figure out how they do this. How are they able to get from point A to point B? What do they use? Do they use magnetic field of the earth? Do they use the sun? How are they able to know where they are going and how to get there? And when you start thinking about the monarchs, this orientation, this being able to travel to where they need to go is especially mysterious. So how do millions of monarchs start their southbound journey from all over Eastern and Central North America and end up in a very small area in the mountains of Central Mexico? And how do Western monarchs find the same overwintering groves year after year? We know that they do not learn the route from their parents, since only about every fourth to fifth generation of North American monarch migrates. Therefore, it is certain that monarchs rely on their instincts rather than learning to find overwintering sites. So when you think about it, the generation that migrated is not the generations that winds up in the original location from where they migrated. Other animals use celestial cues like the sun, moon, or the stars. They use the Earth's magnetic field. They use landmarks like mountain ranges or bodies of water. They use polarized light, infrared energy perception, or some combination of these cues. So they have means and using different things that exist in the environment around them to let them know which way they should be going so they arrive at their destination. Now, when you're talking about the monarch butterfly, the first two are considered the most likely cues that monarchs use and consequently have been studied the most. So we're talking about celestial sun or the Earth's magnetic field being what they think monarchs use to navigate. Because monarchs migrate during the day, the sun is the celestial cue most likely to be used in pointing the way to the overwintering sites. This proposed mechanism is called a sun compass. Monarchs may use the angle of the sun along the horizon in combination with an internal body clock, like a circadian rhythm, to maintain a southwesterly flight path. For example, if a monarch's internal clock reads 10 a.m., then the monarch will fly to the west of the sun to maintain a southern flight direction. And when the monarch's internal clock reads noon or 12 p.m., the monarch's instincts tell it to fly straight towards the sun. While later in the day, the monarch's instincts tell it to fly to the east of the sun. So they use the sun as a means of figuring out which way they should be, which direction they should be flying to get to where they need to go. But this is not enough. This would have to be combined with the use of some other kind of cue. Because if the sun is not present, meaning if it's cloudy or the sun is hidden, then their means of navigation, their cue, is no longer present. And if all the monarchs in Eastern, that's one, and then if all the monarchs in Eastern and Central North America maintained a southwesterly flight, they could never all end up in the same place. It has been proposed that mountain ranges are also important landmarks used by monarchs during their migration. So if we start in New York, or start out in Vermont, or start out in Canada, the fact that you're going southwest, depending on the angle of your, actually they're going south-southwest, so that by itself does not place you in central Mexico. For example, when Eastern monarchs encounter a mountain range, their instincts might tell them to turn south and follow the mountain range. This kind of instinct would serve to funnel monarchs from the entire eastern half of North America to a fairly small region in the mountains of central Mexico. So as long as they, if you see the mountain range in the Rockies, it goes from the northwest to the southeast. So if they encounter those who are flying from the northeast here, if they go south-southwest, they would hit a mountain. Or if they're migrating here from Canada, they would hit a mountain and go along the mountain and eventually wind up in their wintering place in central Mexico. Now, scientists have also suggested that monarchs may use a magnetic compass to orient, possibly in addition to a sun compass, or as a backup orientation guide on cloudy days when they cannot see the sun. Studies of migratory birds have indicated that they register the angle made by the Earth's magnetic field and the surface of the Earth. These angles point south in the northern hemisphere and north in the southern hemisphere. So the animals, birds, actually can sense the Earth's magnetic field, and depending on how that direction they are feeling is oriented, they then know how to travel. Now, again, this is amazing as far as the monarch is concerned, because no one has taught the monarch where to go and how to get there, not the exact root, because the previous three generations, possibly four generations, have never been to the location site. So how do they get this information, and how do they actually travel to make sure to get where they need to go? Now, in 1977, James Cairns conducted experiments to test the way that the migratory monarchs are held. And so he's testing them in a cylindrical flight chamber. And the monarchs are then tested to see which direction they would fly. And what he found was that the monarch flew in a southwesterly direction on sunny days, but they flew in random directions on cloudy days. So this would seem that, and he concluded that the monarchs primarily use the sun to orient, and that magnetic orientation was unlikely, since the monarchs did not appear to be able to orient when they could not use the sun. They could not use the sun. So as long as the sun was present, they flew in a southwesterly direction. However, without the sun, then they just flew around without a specific direction. But Klaus Schmidt Cohen in 2014 reported conflicting evidence. He recorded the vanishing bearings, the direction in which the monarch disappears from sight. So basically, they will take a monarch, focus on a monarch, and check what their direction of flight is, whether north or east or south or west or whatever combination of direction it is. And basically, they will put a trajectory based on where they were flying and the last time that they were seen, when meaning that they were out of sight. And what they found was that wild migratory monarchs, that even on cloudy days, most monarchs still flew in a southwesterly direction. Scientists attempted additional tests of magnetic orientation, but were not able to determine whether monarchs use the Earth's magnetic field to orient. So they thought that possibly the magnetic field was used by the monarchs, but they didn't have the proper test criteria to actually figure this out. But even on cloudy days, most monarchs still flew in a southwesterly direction. So this contradicted the previous study where they flew haphazardly without a specific direction without the sun. But possibly this experiment contains something in addition to the previous experiment that allowed the monarchs to actually navigate properly. But in the Repert lab in 2014, they showed that migratory monarchs indeed possess a magnetic compass that aids in orienting migrants south towards their overwintering grounds during full migration. So these guys were able to find a method, and that was based on the magnetic compass, so which is of course contradictory to the first study that was made. But what everybody missed was that the use of magnetic compass requires shortwave UV light, ultraviolet light, and the previous magnetic compass experiments failed to account for light at this range. Excuse me. So we know that, excuse me, some flying insects, or bees especially, they gravitate to infrared signals from flowers. So they see different things. But it turns out that the monarch needs the ultraviolet light. So this is a very short wave light. And past the old UV light, you go into higher frequency electromagnetic waves that we cannot physically see, or that humans cannot physically see. But obviously, monarchs can see the ultraviolet light. But this was not considered in the previous tests. So once they put in the UV light or ultraviolet light in the field where they were simulating the flight, the eastern migratory monarchs consistently oriented themselves to south. The light-sensitive magnetosensors reside in the adult monarch's antennae. So if you look at these guys, these are the electromagnetic sensors. These are the ones that are able to note the UV light, and based on that UV light and the magnetic field, they're then able to navigate and arrive at their overwintering sites. While the expert consensus remained that the sun compass is the monarch's primary compass for navigation, the author suggests migratory monarchs use the magnetic compass to augment their sun compass. So they don't only use the sun, they don't only use the magnetic field, they don't only use the UV light, they use a combination of the three of them. And possibly including the landmarks. Now, upon dispersal, when they let the monarchs fly, the Central and South American, Atlantic, and Pacific populations lost the ability to migrate. This prompted researchers to identify the gene regions in North American monarchs that appeared highly differentiated from non-migratory populations. So not all monarchs migrate. And they wanted to figure out what the difference between the migrating and the non-migrating monarchs are. Now, there was a study that was done by Kronforst et al. And others in 2014. They identified 536 genes that are significantly associated with migration. One single genomic segment appeared to be divergent in non-migrating populations and was extremely different from the North American populations. So they found one particular gene that was present in one population of migrating monarchs that did not exist or was not selected for in non-migrating populations. So this one gene called collagen 4 alpha 1 showed high divergence between migrating and non-migrating populations. So they actually identified and located this gene. Now, what this gene functions as, and this what this gene does, is that collagen 4 alpha 1 is an important gene for muscle function. And divergence of this gene implicates selection for different flight muscles between the migrating and non-migrating populations. So they were surprised that collagen 4 alpha 1 was downregulated in migratory monarchs, and this perhaps prepared them for lengthy flight. So as long as this gene was present and selected for, then this population would be the migrating population. And on top of this, migrating monarchs had low metabolic rates compared to non-migrants because of muscle performance, lowering energy expenditure in migrating monarchs' muscles. So the migrating monarch uses their energy very efficiently, and the muscles don't use up as much food, as much fuel as the non-migrating monarchs to fly. And their muscle structure then is formed in conjunction with that gene. And this evidence led researchers to conclude that changes in muscle function afforded migrating monarchs the ability to fly farther and use their energy more efficiently. But butterflies are not the only entities that are morphing and changing. The world is always at a different place at every nanosecond as it hurls through space at 29 to 30 kilometers or 18 to 19 miles per second, following our sun that is moving at 200 kilometers or 124.27 miles per second. The physical state of our world also changes due to tidal forces and tectonic plate movements. So we are never in the same place, and we're never in the same shape as far as our planet is concerned and our location in space. Of course, our bodies also are never the same as they were a split second ago, as most cells are replaced over the course of time, and every cell of our body is completely replaced every 7 years. For example, all our heart cells are replaced every 4.5 years. The liver regenerates every 3 years. This means that we have a different body every moment of our lives. However, we are not only changing on the physical level, we are also changing and undergoing an accelerated evolution since the beginning of 1900. The evolution through cosmic energies from the meek mechanism of influences. For the past 6,000 years, we have been undergoing the evolution through the religious texts. This evolution is symbolized by the appointing triangle. As of the year 2000, we are undergoing the evolution symbolized by the downpointing triangle. Actually, this triangle came into effect with the book of, with the Quran. However, now it is exclusively what we're undergoing. So in the Knowledge Book, Fascicle 24, quote, "This triangle symbolizes the religious teaching and the educative mechanism of the divine plan. Triangle of the religious plan. When this plan is completed, education of the downpointing universal triangle comes into effect. Both focal points work collectively. The unification of the two of them as the six-pointed star symbolizes the focal point of the divine plan." So this is the focal point of the divine plan. This is the triangle of universal plan, and this is the religious plan. The six-pointed star is the symbol of the evolution path undergone through the studies of the Knowledge Book. So this is what we're going through by studying the Knowledge Book, by reading the Knowledge Book, and being part of the studies. And what the Knowledge Book does is completes the evolution of the religious or alpha dimension, if necessary, and then conveys us to the omega dimension. So like the growth stages of the monarch butterfly, we also go through separate stages in the process of going to the 19th dimension or the 76th energy dimension. Although we don't see ourselves as different from minute to minute or day to day, we are molting and leaving behind our low energy bodies and transitioning into a higher energy bodies. We are constantly shedding our skin cells, we are constantly shedding hair, we are constantly changing, both inside and outside. We gradually and safely go through a series of steps, a series of thresholds as we progress through the divine plan, universal evolution of this cosmic age. At each step, at each threshold, we have a body, a cell structure that is able to absorb higher and higher dimension energies. So what are these thresholds? In Fascicle 25, that explains, quote, "1, threshold of arrogance, pride, vindictiveness. 2, threshold of possessions, property, matter. 3, threshold of true love, love, friendship. 4, threshold of humanity, self-sacrifice, tolerance. 5, threshold of effacing oneself from one's own self. 6, threshold of attainment and unification. These 6 thresholds are those that should be transited at the first stage. And this is our religious progress, actually. This is the thresholds we go through in our religious progress. Fascicle 25 continued, quote, "Now let us write the thresholds following this. Cosmic energies are received after the 6th step." So basically, the first 6 take us to the religious dimension and prepare us and make us be able to receive cosmic energies easily. So 7 is the threshold of gaining cosmic consciousness. 8, threshold of unifying with the universal consciousness. 9, threshold of being appointed to special missions, like assisting each other and healing in accordance with the consciousnesses. 10, threshold of being habituated to cosmic energies, direct, indirect, and in sleep medium. 11, program of overcoming fears and the threshold of transition. 12, threshold of become being appointed to the path of genuine mission. So this is your transition from the religious dimension to the universal dimension. This is where we meet with the knowledge book. We are able to absorb the studies, the cosmic energies. We are then able to progress and receive a mission. And actually, everyone has come to this planet with a mission. We only need to make sure that we remember that we are here for a mission. And this path, these six thresholds, are actually steps by which we arrive at the point where we do remember what we're supposed to do and actually take up a mission in the knowledge book. So again, Fascicle 24 continues, quote 13, consciousness, cognizance, awareness gained during this mission. 14, logic, accountability gained during this mission. 15, willpower gained during this mission. 16, allegiance, consciousness gained during this mission. 17, universal totality gained during this mission. 18, humane qualities gained during this mission. The first six of the 18 articles we have dictated above carry alpha wave energies. The second six carry beta wave energies. The third six carry gamma wave energies. So as you can see, this is a program within the knowledge book where everyone has an allocated mission, usually in a council or a totality of 18. And this is the threshold we will have to cross and jump over and be able to arrive at consciousness, cognizance, and awareness, logic and accountability, willpower, allegiance, consciousness, universal totality, humane qualities. So these are the evolution steps and thresholds that we need to successfully accomplish in order to be able to continue on to the gamma, to the beta dimension. Sorry, to the omega dimension. And then, of course, Fascicle 25 continues. 19, it is a direct omega gate. One cannot enter here easily. In order to be accepted here, you have to transcend one by one the 18 thresholds listed above. So just like in graduating from grammar school to high school to college, each one of those steps has its own particular educational plan, educational activities, and books and actions we need to take, and growth we need to accomplish. So we go from one to the other to the other, and each step prepares us for the next step. So we start out with, let's say, math, addition, subtractions, then comes division and multiplication, but we go all the way up to where we are using calculus and are doing differential equations. So each step of the education program allows us and grows us to be able to take in the next step of the educational program. And that in turn prepares us for the next one. So in these 18 thresholds, in these 19 thresholds actually, but the 19 is actually the destination. This is where we are supposed to be going to. So you go from alpha, which is the religious dimension. We go through the intermediate state of being prepared for a mission. And then we arrive at the mission that we're supposed to do. We know what the mission is that we're supposed to be doing. And therefore, we are then prepared for the omega dimension by those six steps. And slowly, over time, by following the path designed by the knowledge book, our positive energy increases, our negativity is removed, and our love gradually expands to embrace the totality. And we undergo metamorphosis like the butterfly and will be able to fly to advanced dimensions. So this is a journey that starts out with us being self-centered, us being focus on ourselves and satisfying whatever needs we have in order to exist, in order to live, and to protect ourselves from any outside force that could be harmful to us. When we slowly advance over time to taking care of others, to make sure that another person is not in danger, to make sure that the other person is taken care of, and that everyone eventually will take care of each other and will be able to make sure that everyone is safe. So step by step, there are thresholds we need to cover, we need to go through, and this is our education process, this is our evolution path. So as we said before, we were going through the up-pointing triangle of the religious path. We finally transitioned to the down-pointing triangle of the universal plan, and we are now combining these two. So the knowledge book actually combines these two and takes us step by step from the 72nd energy dimension, which is the alpha dimension, and takes us to the 73rd energy dimension, to the 74th energy dimension, to the 75th energy dimension, and finally to the 76th energy dimension. And we need to be able to absorb the energy in the 76th dimension for us to be able to continue to exist. Because there is a measuring stick, and that measuring stick is actually this measuring stick of Mevlana. And this is the consciousness level of Mevlana. Now, when we start out, we are, as the knowledge book says, we are high on the spiritual plan, but we are low on the lordly plan. Now, the spiritual plan, basically, we're high on that because we have our essence, and our essence is the actual perfect spiritual totality that has been perfect from the get-go. However, the lordly plan starts at the ninth dimension. So we have to be able to go from the third dimension to the eighth dimension, absorb our spiritual totality in the whole, and then we'll be able to transition into the lordly dimension, which is the ninth dimension. So we are composed of two aspects. One is what is called the soul seed, and the other is the energy seed. So our soul seed is actually perfect. That is our spiritual essence. That is that bit of divine consciousness that is in us. And the energy seed is the one that has to be grown. That's the one that has to be cultivated. That's the one that has to go through all these evolution steps to be able to be at the same level as the spiritual totality. And once we're at the same level from the spiritual totality, then from the ninth dimension onward is the lordly dimension. And then we are completely different beings. We are able to take our bodies into the far dimensions, the advanced dimensions. So little by little, step by step, we are able to progress, and especially with the programs of the knowledge book, we are able to go through this easily and safely and gradually without hurting ourselves and without being confused or becoming confused. Okay, so we're almost at the end of our discussion today. Please remember that the Knowledge Book website is www.usa.theknowledgebook.net. The Turkish website is calltofriendship.org. My telephone number is 973-787-7035. And my email address is mmjp99@gmail.com. mmjp99@gmail.com. So please do call me with any questions, or text me, or email me with any questions that you may have about this topic or any other topic that we've talked about. And if you have any suggestions of topics that you would like to cover, please also contact me. Thank you very much. Stay safe. All the best. Love. Take care.
You've been listening to Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasik. Marge was led to the Knowledge Book, a gift to humanity, at its time of transition to the Golden Age that provides the truth, energies, and knowledge. Now, she shares information from and answers questions about the Knowledge Book with you the fourth Tuesday each month at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. For more information, visit usa.theknowledgebook.net and tune in next time for another amazing show on Knowledge Book Radio.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.